Good evening again. I had it on and then I turned it off. I was asked where I come from, and in reality I come from a foreign country, so Taos, New Mexico. Pretty foreign. In fact, you don't recognize how foreign it is till you leave, and then you realize this place is really different. Roman Catholic background, very, very liberal politically, so that's my background. Became a believer at the Christian University of New Mexico. I'm glad you laughed. It's probably more secular than the University of Texas or whatever down here. But anyway, the Lord put me amongst real believers, and I saw the Christian life lived out, and it was attractive. So the encouraging thing is you can come from one of the most liberal places, Roman Catholic, it doesn't matter, the Lord can get a hold of your life. Going through an engineering program, so that's kind of my background in terms of the sciences, and kind of naturally led to checking out how does the Bible fit in with all this engineering and science and stuff. So I've been studying and looking at this for like 35 years, since last century, obviously. I'm really 98, but don't tell anybody. Well, let's continue looking at science and the scriptures, and let's start off with a scripture. For by him all things, this is in the New Testament, this is the Apostle Paul. By him all things were created, both in the heavens and on the earth. So Paul recognizes astrophysics as part of God's creation. And on the earth, geophysics, visible and invisible. So things that you can't see. We talked about language, but there's also a spiritual realm, things visible and invisible. So it includes angels, whether thrones or dominions, and this probably alludes to the spiritual realm, thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. So there's a purpose. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Colossians 1:16-17. So another creation passage. Now from the New Testament, I've given you mainly passages out of the Old Testament. So there's creation passages and there's flood passages in both New and Old Testament, in fact, throughout the Bible. So the last hour we were looking at the flood, the Genesis flood versus historical geology. We haven't gotten into historical geology yet, just kind of alluding to it and touching on it. The focus last hour was, why do we hold to a universal flood if there's no evidence for it, according to the historical geologist? Are we just basing our thoughts on wishful thinking? If science is going against it, then why do you want to bother looking at mythological writings? Well, the scripture is clear and unambiguous in that it describes a massive flood. In fact, we could describe it as worldwide. So we want to investigate in this hour, and again, next Tuesday, we'll look at the scientific evidence. So I'm going to give you some more. And throughout all of this, well, the scientific evidence, I'll just tell you ahead of time, is overwhelming in support of a worldwide flood or a universal flood. And it actually undermines the whole idea of the conclusions of historical geology and even evolution. And I hope we can see that as we look at some of the evidence. And my plan is not to argue, just to explain why I'm right. We mentioned that In simple language, the record of geology, you can view it as coming about as a result of a little bit of water over lots of time. That's the historical geologist viewpoint. The viewpoint, and I think the biblical viewpoint, is lots of water over a little bit of time will produce the same thing. So it's a matter of interpreting the data, which one fits better. And I think actually the biblical flood description fits better all of the sciences that we're going to look at. And I'm going to give you many different sciences. We're going to look at geophysics. We're going to look at paleontology. We're going to look oceanography. We'll even touch on mountain building and some other areas as well. And I've divided it up into basically how the Bible presents the flood. So I describe this as flood stages. And I want to start off with what caused it to begin with, physically. What are the physical phenomenon that accounts for what we have? And is there any evidence for it? And I already hinted at that John Baumgartner, a geophysicist from Los Alamos National Labs, in fact, that was his work. He's retired now. In fact, I just spoke with him today, I think, because he's doing a seminar in Albuquerque, and I'm over here in Houston. So we're both going to do a little bit of geophysics, you might say. He came up with what is now known as the Baumgartner flood model, and that's what caused the Genesis flood. And I've already hinted at it, so let me give you some more detail. So what he describes is related to tectonic movements. All over the planet, in fact, the planet, the crust of the earth is made up of these huge plates, continent-wide, continent-sized plates. They're under the oceans as well. And they're a little bit independent in that they move against each other, and that's what causes earthquakes and tsunamis and that sort of thing. Today, when you have little movements, tremendous energy is displaced. But his theory, and he has a computer model that I'll describe as well, his theory is that during the Genesis flood, or beginning and causing the Genesis flood, was catastrophic tectonic movements. Not just slight movements, but just massive movements at rapid speeds, and his computer model actually bears this out. So we'll talk about tectonic movements, and I'm going to use this slide to kind of explain some of the sciences. So we're going to talk about geophysics, which today there's a whole science called flood geology, and it's not pseudoscience. It is a real science by PhD, well-documented but well-educated creationists that have come up with the things that I'm going to share with you. None of this, I'm not a geophysicist, I'm not a biologist, in fact, I'm nothing. I just gather the information and share it. But this is the work of many geophysicists, not just John Baumgartner, but others that are involved in what we could describe today as flood geology. In other words, looking at the same data and interpreting the data from a biblical worldview and realizing that actually the data points in that direction as it is. So we're going to look at geophysics, and we'll look a little bit at plate tectonics that I just described. And I mentioned the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and this is where the thinking began in terms of Baumgartner coming up with his flood model. It's well known today, I mentioned it was discovered during World War II by people that were in submarines, and they made soundings to figure out, you know, how far they were from the bottom. And they realized that there was a whole mountain range under the Atlantic Ocean. And according to Genesis, we looked at Genesis 1, and I mentioned that more than likely there might have been, now, indicators in the Baumgartner model seems to give some indication along these lines. But it seems like on day three, when God created landmass and separated it from the waters, doesn't state it explicitly, but it gives you the impression that there might have been just one landmass. And some people call it Pangaea. And if you kind of look at it, you can see where the continents, North America, South America, Africa, at one time may have been joined together, possibly. This is kind of a theory, you might say, even Australia and then all of Europe and Asia together there. So if this was the case, preceding the flood, or as a result of the breakup of these continents and the movement of these plates, North America is on at least one plate. I don't remember. It probably has a couple of others. San Andreas Fault, you've heard of it. That's the joining of two different plates. But anyway, the model basically assumes that the continents were close together. And there is a mid-Atlantic ridge that separates a plate that basically has all of Africa and North America and South America, two different plates there. In fact, I'll show you some charts later on. So the Baumgartner model, I'm going to use this slide to kind of develop it here. He developed what he describes as a finite element model that models the whole Earth. And when he was doing work at Los Alamos National Lab, he did all of this on his own. The government didn't fund him, even though he was into geophysics, but they permitted him. And they were very interested as well in what he was doing. And this finite element model was so detailed and took up so much computer space, I guess is that the right word? Memory. That he had to do most of his work like at 3 a.m. or 2 a.m. because if he ran his program, it would basically take all of the computer capability and no one else would be able to do any work. So he developed this model that basically modeled the Earth. And when you run it, you can have a runaway situation where these plates basically move very rapidly. Some of them subduct, that's a geological term. Subduction is when a plate goes back into the mantle. In other words, it just goes down into liquid rock, you might say. So this finite element model models these movements of these plates, plate tectonics. And under certain conditions, obviously God produced them, but under certain actual physical conditions that God orchestrated, these plates moved at a very rapid pace and lots of catastrophic events took place associated with it. So that's the model. So we have pre-flood oceans and ocean floors. And according to the model, we have a subducting of the ocean floors. In other words, the ocean floors went back into the mantle. Okay? And when that happens, these plates pull apart. Now, this is one of his sketches. In fact, I think Russ Humphreys put this together, but it basically describes Baumgartner's model here. So you have the subducting, the green little sketch there with the arrow there, that would represent ocean floor that is going down. See how it's subducting? See the arrow there? It's going back into hot rock, into the mantle. You all are a little bit familiar with below the crust of the earth is mantle material, lava that comes up in volcanoes. Well, it's obviously everything dissolves and goes into the mantle. So that pre-flood, the oceans were split apart like at the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. So the red there would be the formation of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge and the subducting of the existing ocean floors. And this would cause, just like earthquakes today, and in fact tsunamis today are caused by earthquakes as well, little movements of the plates. It would cause mega tsunamis, greater than anything we've ever seen today. And these tsunamis would overtake the land masses, and particularly that Pangaea, and destroy everything on it. In fact, sweep everything on the surface away to depths of hundreds of feet as these tsunamis just eroded everything. And just kind of an example of, on a small scale, the destruction. This was the tsunami in Japan a few years ago. Somebody caught a photograph as it began to hit the land there, did just massive destruction. Imagine that multiplied hundreds of times, just covering every continent, well, the one continent, wiping out all of the surface. And the opening of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, where now you have hot mantle rock in contact with water, the ocean. So you have this very deep in the oceans. And what would you expect would happen? You'd have rapid evaporation, in fact, explosive evaporation. So there's the formation of, in the Atlantic, you have the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and in the Pacific, you have something similar. It's called the Pacific Ring of Fire. You've heard of that. You have a similar thing going on there, and that would have been going on during the Genesis flood as well. So you have hot mantle rock in contact with water and would produce that steam that's in the middle of the drawing there. So you have, this is what he describes as the fountains of the deep. So the fountains of the deep, an old creation theory was the fountains of the deep. There had to have been underground reservoirs of water that contained lots of water. And the old theory is that they burst. These underground reservoirs burst and water came gushing up out of the waters and flooding the land. Well, this is a far better description and a far better model than that old model. That was the best that we had. But that's gone by the wayside. But a lot of the books, some of the creation books will still describe that. But this one has replaced that theory. And we have never found those reservoirs, for one thing. But we do know that there's the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and we also know that there's the Ring of Fire. That exists, and we know what caused them now. This kind of a phenomenon, okay? So, with the contact of mantle rock with the water, the ocean water, you would have these supersonic streams, jets of water that would be shot up into the air just because of the heat and the evaporation, the rapid evaporation of water molecules, basically. So now that would produce this thick clouding all over the earth that would result in 40 days and 40 nights of rain. Climatologists will argue today that the atmosphere cannot contain enough water, even at a supersaturated state, to produce a 40-day and 40-night rainstorm. I mean, it's just physically impossible. So you have to have a source like the Baumgartner model supplies, because you have a continuous supply of steam until you get stabilization. In other words, when the water cools the rock down, and then it stops. And apparently it took 40 days to get that. So you have these jets of water shot into the clouds there. So you have thick clouds and you have this intense rain. And we have the evidence of it, the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. This is just another better sketch of what it would look like if you took all of the water out of the oceans. Obviously you have Africa on the right and South America and North America on the left. And it goes pole to pole. And it's volcanic. It's mantle rock. Nobody disputes that. And they're separating very slowly. But the model says they would have separated rapidly such that it formed that whole mountain range underwater somewhat rapidly. And again, you have these plates. There's the Mid-Atlantic one. And you have some in the Atlantic and in the Indian Ocean there. And there's the Pacific Ring of Fire, where you have the same phenomenon. You have underground mountains, and some of the mountains are on the surface. So you have islands, Hawaiian Islands, for example, in the middle. But you also have all of Japan and other islands as well. So he describes what took place during the flood as continental sprint. Today they call it continental drift because it's just quarter of an inch, half an inch at a time. But during the flood, this would have been a rapid movement of plates moving hundreds of miles an hour or somewhere in that range, such that we have the continents that exist today and the land masses today and then the oceans. And then that Psalm 104 indicates that God set the boundaries. So it's stabilized, and we have stabilization after the flood. So the fountains of the deep, and then you have that 40-day rainstorm produced by that effect indicated by the Baumgartner model. And by the way, that finite element model models all of this in terms of the tectonic effects. All of that is, he demonstrates it. And he's got some technical articles out if any of you are interested. In fact, he has a website. What is it called? I'll give you those websites towards the end. Okay? So, 7:11 in the sixth, and notice, let me remind you, we talked about the detailed narrative in the 600th year of Noah's life. So Noah's 600 years old. In the second month, if that's not enough, on the 17th day of the month. It's dated to the day. And they disembark, we have another dating to the day, so we can come up with 370 days. Got it? On the same day, all the fountains of the great deep burst. So the fountains of the great deep are these jets of water that burst and now are producing these tremendous clouds. Does that make sense? Fits the description. And the floodgates of the sky were opened. Now we have this tremendous 40-day rainstorm. Floodgates of the sky were open. The rain fell upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. So just have an observation of how long it took. It doesn't give us the Baumgartner model, but it would fit the description. So we have a massive flood. The fountains of the deep includes a 40-day rain. And the text I've already mentions a 150-day storm. The waters prevailed, it says, for 150 days. And then it gives another 150-day, and it's possible that it's describing a receding of the water. So this is massive. This is huge. And this is what you would expect on the scale of the Baumgartner model. So the total that Noah and his family were on the ark was 377 days because they were there 7 days ahead of the flood, the beginning of Genesis chapter 7. I gave you the chronology. So this describes the intense global rain, 40 days, 40 nights. So the water's prevailing, and you would, as a result of the tsunamis, you would be 100-foot waves or more, greater, more than 100-foot waves that would sweep across the continent, and now that they're breaking up continents, ripping up everything in its path. And you know the destructiveness of water. You know it from these small floods here. Would rip up entire forests, just everything in its path, and would transport it, in some cases, thousands of miles. Transport it, and then, as the hydraulics dictates, the waters would slow down, and you would get the settling of different materials, and that's what produces the geological column that we can observe today. Does that make sense? So this is all happening within a 370-day period, in fact, a shorter period. But within that time frame, not billions of years, the geological column that you can observe today was formed. So we don't dispute the existence of these layers. They're there. Nor do we dispute the order. The only one of the things that we dispute is the time that it took to lay them down. So instead of a little bit of water over long periods of time, lots of water over the duration of the Genesis flood. Make sense? So that's basically the Baumgartner model. And you would have massive erosion on every landmass because it covered every landmass. Everything is covered by water. And you have tsunami-like waters moving across the land. And then you'd have the accumulation of the layers. That's called sedimentation in geology. And it would produce the geological column. So that's our interpretation all the way down to the Cambrian layer. And I'm gonna talk a little bit about, there's a radical difference. In fact, if you go to the Grand Canyon, they will describe the great unconformity. How many of you have been to the Grand Canyon? Okay, most of you. Do you remember hearing about the great unconformity? That's a geological description. And this is what geologists call it, the great unconformity, because it's great. The rocks below the great unconformity are radically different. They're not sedimentary rock. They are creation rock, we would say. But the Precambrian rock is mantle rock and original rock. Everything above that, well, I'm using this, I'll come back to this. Everything above the Precambrian, where it says absence of fossils, multicellular life, that line there, we would see that as the destruction of the Genesis flood to that point, and then the redepositing of all of that material after the Genesis flood. Rapidly. Well, rapidly in terms of not billions, but matter of weeks. Okay. Now, the thing to note, the argument that they use is that this is billions of years, but, and I mentioned this is theoretical, but it has lots of problems from their interpretation that a Genesis flood solves all of the problems that they have. For one, it's theoretical, and less than 1% of the earth has all of them. So there's virtually not very many places where all of them. And some studies have been done. What's his first name? Morapi. There's a book. What's his first name? I'm trying to remember. Anyway, he's done some studies and he's put together geological studies. And they've studied these layers all over the earth and come up with these numbers. But if you look at all of the continents, yeah, there's Wood Merapi. You can't quite see the white. There's a few there, the tip of Australia there, and there's a few little white spots. That's less than 1%. Those are the areas where a sampling of 10, where you have all of the 10. In other words, representative of only the 10. So in reality, the whole geological column doesn't exist anywhere. But if you do the major ones below and then group some of the top ones, less than 1%, you have all of them. Okay? And so the dark is you don't have all of them, which is virtually all of the landmass there. Okay? Did I miss something here? Yeah. Okay. So that's one problem. And another problem is it's based on evolution. They date the rocks based on the fossils that are in the rocks on an evolutionary scheme, basically, saying that the less complex creatures are at the bottom and mammals and more complex are at the top. And that is the case, but there is a creationist explanation why that would happen. Mammals and other creatures and humans would flee the flood, and they would be the last to die and most of them would die as a result of drowning rather than being covered. So they would not be covered in these layers. Okay. And 66%, you have lots of the layers missing. Okay. And here's an example of the Cambrian layer, that lower layer. So you can see it covers almost all of Africa, much. It's the other way around. It's the white. It's the most of North America, half of South America, and only the northern part of Africa, most of Asia, and about half of Europe, two-thirds of Australia. The Cambrian layer is present. And he's got the Wood Merapi has several of these different drawings there. So here's the problems. Some cases, some of them are out of order. One that's supposed to be older is out of order, etc. So anyway, we're back to our little chart. If you start off with an evolutionary, historical geology background and uniformitarianism, etc., then you're going to see millions and millions of years in the geological record, and you're going to interpret the fossil record in that light. If you come from a biblical perspective, you have added data, you have revelation that tells us that there's a universal flood that you can see somewhere, and you're going to end up with a different conclusion. So plate tectonics, that's a little bit of what caused the flood. And the science of paleontology, that's, I mentioned fossilology, remember that? It's a study of fossils. And the whole science of fossils argues for a universal flood. And let me give you the reasons for that. First of all, let me ask you the question, are fossils formed today? It's a yes and no question. So your odds of being correct are 50%. You're afraid to guess. In general, no. Okay. In general, fossils are not formed today. It takes catastrophic conditions to form a fossil. Okay. So just the existence of fossils argues for catastrophic conditions. Right? Here's an example of a well-formed fossil, and I can show you hundreds of specimens. What happens to creatures when they die today? Do they wait and then they slowly become fossils? What happens to them? Easy question. They either decay or they're eaten up. So here's an example of a creature that was dead and not much of it is going to be left after these vultures take care of it. So creatures don't fossilize in general. You have to have a covering of them and sealing of them such that the decay process doesn't disintegrate them as well. So in general, fossils don't form except under catastrophic conditions. And by the way, there's virtually no fossils in below the Cambrian layer. The fossils are all above. And I should have mentioned, all of the layers starting with the Cambrian layer are laid down by more than likely water. Now the evolutionist might argue wind and or water, but water is the more likely cause. Sedimentary rock, by definition, is water laid or layers laid down by flooding or water. And all of the layers from the including the Cambrian all the way to the surface, is sedimentary rock all over the face of the earth. And they're full of fossils. And each of those layers indicates that catastrophic conditions existed in order to form all those fossils. See how it fits a Genesis flood a lot better? Okay. This is just the first argument here. So what happens to a creature? Here's a AIG drawing. They do a lot of good work here, so I use their drawings. Fish dies. It's eaten up. A few bones fall to the surface. This is not generally the case. Fish doesn't just sit there. and wait for a while, and then gets covered slowly, and then eventually is covered, and now you have a fossil? That's rare. In fact, doesn't happen, actually. You have to have catastrophic conditions. And this is admitted by historical geologists, for example, Miller here, an evolutionist. Comparatively few remains of organisms now inhabiting the Earth are being deposited under conditions favorable for their preservation as fossils. We don't have the right conditions. It is nevertheless remarkable that so vast a number of fossils are embedded in the rocks. How'd they get there? So the present, even according to their admission, is not a key to the past. So this is beginning to erode the idea of uniformitarianism already, even by their own admission. So fossils, here's what happens. You have a fish swimming, very happy, as you can see, smiling, smiley fish. And all of a sudden we have catastrophic conditions. And now it's sealed such that it does not decay and obviously is not eaten because it's sealed off. And now you have a fossil. You have the chemical reactions and the chemical replacement of at least the bones, and sometimes even replacement of even flesh material that hardens and becomes a fossil. Another evolutionist and historical geologist, William Lamberts, almost all of the fossils, by their very manner of perfect preservation, clearly show a sudden burial. He could have said catastrophic burial. No decay. It has to be sudden. If you have decay, if you have time, then you can have either decay or predators will eat it. And they admit this. I mean, this is the weakness of their whole theory. Genesis flood, you have the perfect conditions to preserve all of the animals that were swept up and covered and preserved for us. So just the first argument, just the existence of fossils argues for catastrophic conditions, and the Bible tells us the flood was catastrophic. There's also, all over the world, what are called fossil graveyards. Not just individual fossils here and there, but a fossil graveyard is evidence that massive amounts of creatures were all gathered together. And remember the drawing? The waters would have swept up and transported all of these animals, and they would have been swept up, to some of them together, and then some of them would have been deposited together, and there's a variety of them. So these fossil graveyards that exist all over the world are graveyards of the accumulation of many different kinds, some of them predominant in some cases, but many kinds in one place, and they all died at the same time. That's a fossil graveyard, and they exist all over the world. If they exist all over the world, that speaks of a worldwide flood. Okay? The historical geologist has a hard time explaining them. And there's examples in Siberia, and I could give you some details here. In fact, you can go to some of the books and get the details. You've heard of the woolly mammoths. So you have hundreds or maybe even thousands, I don't know the numbers, but thousands probably of these mammals. And in fact, some of them have been found with the contents of the dinner they had the day, and other creatures along with them. But the predominant numbers in Siberia are these woolly mammoths. They all died at the same time, and they were all preserved at the same time under catastrophic conditions. You have similar phenomenon in graveyards in Alaska, Germany. The point of this slide is worldwide. Argentina, in the U.S., Wyoming, there are fossil graveyards. Utah, in fact, Utah, we have the famous Dinosaur National Monument, where virtually hundreds of dinosaurs all died together in the same place. They were all swept together and deposited together, and they all died together, and they were fossilized together. And a dinosaur, you're talking about, that's not even a Houston flood. That's a huge flood. Bigger than a Houston one. Okay? And here's an example of just one that they preserved in a museum there. Reconstructed. Some of the parts have to be replaced. But essentially the whole thing was found. So not only Utah, but Colorado, the La Brea Pits in Southern California, that's a fossil graveyard. So these exist all over is the point that I'm making here. Here's an interesting kind of fossil. They're called polystrate fossil. You can probably figure out from the word there, poly is what? Many. Straight. Strata. Yeah, you got it. Strata or layering, you might say. So we're talking about many layers. That's a polystrate fossil. In other words, a fossil that goes through many layers. This is a real problem for the historical geologist because they say any of these layers, some of these layers, remember the Jurassic, what was it, 45 billion million years to form the Jurassic? And we have creatures that go through many layers. That's a polystrate fossil. Here's some examples. Here, and again, the point that I'm making here is I'm showing different locations. They exist all over the world. This is not an anomaly. These are not rare, you might say. Here's one, and in the drawing there, or the photograph there, there's a 1 meter layer. It's a small layer. So there's a layer above and a layer below, and probably more than one layer. And we have a tree, and the trunk of the tree didn't grow over those millions of years. It's the same size. So is that tree millions and millions of years old, or might it have all been buried and the layers deposited more rapidly within months? So that's an example of a polystrate fossil. And these aren't rare. Here's a sketch of polystrate fossils in France. And you can see relatively thin layers there, but you have multiple layers is the point. That's a polystrate fossil. Here's one in Tennessee and what might even appear like a coal bed below, but you can see a distinct difference in the layering there at the bottom there. And then you see some other layering at the top. So they occur here in the United States. And by the way, this is John Baumgartner, last century. He's a little older now. When he was doing his research. But here's one that he found and photographed, took his photograph of a polystrate fossil in Kentucky. Point being, they're all over. They're not that rare, I guess you could say. So they're worldwide as well. So you have the same phenomenon occurring in all over different locations all over the world. Dinosaurs tend to be polystrate fossils because they're so huge. So a lot of dinosaurs are polystrate fossils as well. They're not just individual creatures, but they go through various layers. So the historical geologist has a very hard time explaining how this could happen and how that same animal couldn't be millions of years old. And by the way, there's a lot of other scientific evidence that dinosaurs are relatively recent and lived with mankind, just like the Bible indicates. Another cutting-edge science, we're finding DNA in some dinosaur bones, DNA and actually flexible collagen and different parts of the dinosaur. So dinosaurs oftentimes are polystrate. So the whole area of fossils are a problem for the historical geologist, and they give support. You can imagine, same thing, if you have a wave of water more than 100 feet deep, it's going to wipe out dinosaurs. Not just little creatures, but everything in its path. In fact, entire forests. I'll talk about that next. Do you know what coal beds are? Coal beds are what? They're actually the fossil remains of plant life. And most coal beds are probably the result of being fossilized because they are preserved and covered by layers above them, and they're probably made up of forests, the pre-flood forests that existed before the Genesis flood. So coal petrology and petrophysics, that's kind of a scientific word for oil, basically. Same thing, except that's animal material that is liquefied, I guess you'd call it. So oil are biological remains, basically. They call them fossil fuels, right? Okay. A Genesis flood explains this very nicely. It'd be the same phenomenon, just rapid erosion and displacement of animals, forests, et cetera, and then redeposited in a new location. And then covered, and a lot of these are covered by many layers. That's what has preserved them and kept them from decaying and basically has fossilized the plant life and the animal life. And there's huge coal beds. The traditional explanation of peat bogs just doesn't fit. For one, you don't have soil material at the bottom of it that you would expect, or above it. And by the way, that excavator there, just to give you a scale, you can't make out the tracks there, but the tracks on that vehicle are probably about 12 foot high. So you have a tractor about this, the tracks are about like that, or higher. I guess I can't reach that high. this is a huge excavator, but gives you a scale. So that coal bed is more than 100 feet deep. And that's not uncommon all over the world. In fact, one of the reasons I think Putin wants to take over Ukraine is because they have these huge coal beds and other resources as well. One of the conclusions, this is Baumgartner in some of his research, most coal was formed from plant material, transported and buried by marine, that's ocean, marine floodwaters rather than from plants which accumulated in place in swamps or peat bogs. That's the historical geologist explanation, peat bogs. But the data just didn't fit. Rather, and obviously he believes in the Genesis flood, rather they're the material that's transported. And by the way, if you look at the microstructure of coal, you see alignment. In other words, you see the action of water aligning the materials and then preserving them in a somewhat of an aligned configuration. So that's petrophysics. So we've talked about plate tectonics, paleontology. We've talked about geophysics. We've talked about coal petrology. We've talked about petrophysics. Let's spend our remaining time talking about geology, and particularly geology in the area of sedimentation. In other words, let's study these layers. And a real good place to do that, how many of you have been to the Grand Canyon? Okay, good. You saw the Grand Canyon is a monument to God's judgment. Because you can see many of the layers. In fact, you can see the layers all the way down to below the Precambrian rock. The Colorado River is below that Precambrian layer or layers. So let's take a look at Grand Canyon evidence. Just to give you a feel for the Grand Canyon. As much as a mile deep. So we're talking about a mile deep of layering. And this is pretty typical. That's about what you have. Some places it's deeper and other places it's shallower. But at the Grand Canyon, you have about a mile deep of these layers, these geological layers. And it's as much as 18 miles across, and the length of it is about 277 miles long. So we have lots of opportunities to see lots of geology and lots of God's handiwork and God's judgment. Well, why do the evolutionists... Okay, I thought this is where I thought I was going to end, but we got some more time. Let me skip over this. I thought I was going to end here. I'm going a little bit faster. Let's look at the evidence. And I've got a list of just areas that give evidence of a massive worldwide flood is these massive blankets. And you can come up with these sketches that that you can find in geology books that kind of describe the geology. And a typical area here, we're looking at the Grand Canyon at the right there, at the bottom there. That's kind of the scale of the Grand Canyon. But you have all of these layers, and they're pretty flat, you might say. And you can go all the way into Bryce Canyon, up into Utah, and you have all of these layers. Some of them are thicker, some of them are thinner. But that's the geological record. And they give them different names, but they would fit the chart that I showed you earlier, even though they call them different formations. That Tapetes layer, that yellow one there at the bottom horizontal one, that would be a Cambrian layer. Okay? And the boundary between that Cambrian layer and the rock below it is Precambrian. You can see on the left bottom there, Precambrian rock. And notice it's mantle rock. And in some cases, right close to the mantle, and you might have some even molten rock at the bottom. So the Grand Canyon goes below the Cambrian layer and goes down into the Precambrian layer. So you can observe the geology, basically, of the Grand Canyon, and you can see lots of those layers. And like I said, everything above the Precambrian, because it's flat, is, well, not because of that, but the flatness indicates that it's sedimentary rock, laid down more than likely by water. In fact, the evidence is water rather than wind. And here's just one formation, Shiner Rump Formation. And what I'm emphasizing here, we have these huge blankets of the same material. 125,000 square miles, and this is North America only. And it's all the same. In other words, this graded rock, and that's kind of a sketch. It takes up a little tiny corner of Texas. Sorry, I should have got a different map that shows more Texas. But northern part of New Mexico, the area where I grew up, goes all the way into Canada. Same material. Same layer. In other words, if you drilled in Canada, you would encounter the same layer with the same fossils as you do down in the south part in New Mexico. In fact, you can see, I don't know if you've driven to northern New Mexico between Albuquerque and Santa Fe, you can see the edge of that. Now it's down below, but you can see the rock above it. It's very distinct. But the point I'm making is you have these huge blankets of the same material, and how do you explain that from a historical geology perspective? And where did all that material come from to form these large blankets? And the Tapetes layer, there's the Tapetes layer, covers almost all of the United States. Same material. So we're too close to the coast here in Houston to have a Tapetes layer. But if you go Wichita, Kansas, somewhere in there, Amarillo, and then obviously west and north, and go up to New England, if you drill down to the right level, you'll find the same material as you find in the Grand Canyon. It'd be the same Tapete's layer, which is the Cambrian layer. So that's evidence of massive deposition of the same material all together, all at the same time. So you have these massive blankets, and you have what is called folding. And what seems to have happened when the Genesis flood deposited all of these layers, they're pretty flat. And that's what happens when you can observe that today when you have a flood and you have pretty much a uniform flat layering, if you will. But because of all of the tectonic action that's still stabilizing, you're going to have a lot of geological activity, and you're going to have plates still moving and producing other effects. And this folding are some of these effects. And you can see most of the layers are pretty flat, but then you see that one towards the right there, just off the middle, you have this angling. That's folding. At one time, closer to the depositing, that was flat. And by the way, geologists recognize that it had to have been not rock yet. In other words, it was still soft, just by the way that it was formed, the cracking, etc. You'd expect more cracking, but it was formed when it was still pliable, if you will. Here's a better example, and it kind of shows up in the coloring. That one layer at one time was all flat, but because of movements of tectonic plates and squishing of some areas and movement of other areas, you have this folding. And this is very common. You can see this at the Grand Canyon. You can see this everywhere. So it's telling you that after the flood and after all of the layers were deposited, you're still having the earth moving towards stability. So you have massive blankets, you have folding, crossbedding, and this is evidence of water. And what crossbedding is, I'm not sure I can describe it. Here's an example. There's Baumgartner again, the Coconino sandstone. Crossbedding, the way that the material is laid down, they call it crossbedding. You have a certain angle. If you've seen sand dunes, the material is laid down at an angle. Wind sets it down at a particular, depending on the material, a certain angle. The angle of most of this rock is at an angle that water, that you find at water. You have the same phenomenon with water moving, crossbedding. And this is the Coconino sandstone. You can't quite see the crossbedding, but geologists can observe it. So just the way that the material was laid down indicates water action. Amphitheaters. Well, why don't we save this one for Tuesday, and we'll give you more sedimentary evidence. There's others, in fact, even more spectacular. But if you've gone to the Grand Canyon, they talk about these amphitheaters. Those amphitheaters, more than likely, were formed as a result of water action, eddying of waters. I'll show you some other sketches of that later on. Any questions? I've got a couple of minutes here. Barb.
Somebody wrote in said, how do creationists account for fossils of species that no longer exist?
Of species that no longer exist?
Yeah, like Tyrannosaurus.
Yeah. We, at least I believe, that the post-flood world is radically different than the pre-flood world. And like dinosaurs, it's harsher than the pre-flood world, and they were not able to survive. I do believe that dinosaurs were on the ark. I mean, the text seems to indicate that. In other words, all of the animals were on the ark. So the animals that have gone extinct, and some of them went extinct as a result of the flood. And the ones that were on the ark, some of them could not thrive after because of the harshness of the post-flood environment. So that's basically the way we answer that one. That was a good question, though. Any other questions?
In the pre-flood world, mankind, people would have had structures and some sort of civilization. I never heard anybody say that they found evidence of that.
Yeah, there are a tiny few artifacts that have been found, axe heads in some coal beds and some other containers. I'm trying to remember some of the things that I've seen or at least written about, but very little. And part of that is attributed to just the massive destruction of the floodwaters that didn't allow preservation, and apparently there weren't that many, apparently. Yeah. But there are a few artifacts that are a little bit odd, that are not explainable, and possibly from the pre-flood world, as you're mentioning there.
Well, I was amazed at these coal beds, and that, I mean, they're deep, and that, if they're coming from plants, like you said, I mean, that could be a whole forest.
Yes.
That was buried quickly.
More than likely a whole forest, yeah. And it appears, not only from the description, but from the fossil record, that the pre-flood world was much more lush than the post-flood world. Much more plant life. So that would account for these massive coal beds, thick coal beds over long distances.
Countries, I guess, now,
right,
that are still there.
Yes.
The coal beds that are still there.
Well, we haven't.
God is still providing.
And by the way, there's always grace. There's judgment of the Genesis flood, but there's grace in that God not only preserved 8 people that would result in you and I, we're related, by the way, through Noah. But the grace that God provided energy for us in the 21st century and abundance of energy. So God is a gracious God. Let's pray. Father, we continue to be amazed at just your grace and your goodness and your care for all of us. And we just praise you and worship you tonight and bless your name. And may we deepen our relationship and our walk with you, to just continually, as we observe the world in which we live in, to see your hand in it, and even your hand of judgment. And we know that your judgment is good, because you are good. So we praise you in Jesus' name. Amen. Now, Sunday, what I plan to do is continue the Genesis 3 passage. And one of the things that I'm going to try to show is there's a